The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. The podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing is intended as investment advice. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Lucas Tamicki, you manage a long-biased equity fund, a concentrated equity fund, and you have a couple of pretty contrarian views here, but I wanted to back up just a bit with the environment here as we head into 2020. Obviously, you're not a macro guy, but there's a lot of debate of value versus growth, interest rates. There are a lot of variables in play here. So maybe a good place to start would be how you view the world and where you perceive there to be opportunities on the long side.
Absolutely. And thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today. The way I think about the world is really from a bottoms up perspective, thinking about individual companies. And in our investment strategy, we're exclusively interested in companies with three characteristics. We're looking for businesses that have some kind of sustainable competitive advantage, something that allows them to earn a high rate of return on invested capital and then sustain those returns for many years into the future. Secondly, we're looking for businesses that can actually grow and reinvest within those competitive advantages. And third, we're looking for management teams that are intelligent allocators of capital, because again, the management teams are ultimately that link between the business value and shareholder value. And my general view of the world is that the world, and especially the corporate world, is sort of unfair. And there are better businesses and there are worse businesses. And frankly, most businesses are donkeys. And there are a couple of businesses out there that are thoroughbreds. And over the long term, your returns as a shareholder are going to be determined by the underlying returns of the business on a per share basis. So I think exceptional returns to shareholders come from exceptional business performance. So we're first and foremost trying to figure out where are these exceptional companies. And that's where we're hunting.
Interesting. I like the whole thoroughbreds versus donkeys. Not sure I heard that before. Okay, so that's where you're hunting. Now, so where does one go now? What are some areas that you like, sector-wise, maybe company-wise?
To us, competitive advantage really can be derived from four main categories. And this then leads us to where we spend our time hunting. So number one, let me just quickly give you the four categories, and then that will sort of help inform our discussion going forward. There's really four things I would consider a source of competitive advantage. Number one, you may have some intangible assets, brands, patents, licenses, government approvals, things that inhibit competitive entry and make it harder for competitors to get in and compete away your profits. Secondly, some businesses have network effects, and those will arise when the product or service becomes more and more valuable as market share grows. Third, some companies have very high switching costs, and switching costs arise anytime it's risky, expensive, difficult, or time-consuming to change suppliers. And this then leads to long-term customer relations and pricing power. And finally, some businesses benefit from sustainable cost advantages. And these are generally tied to a hard-to-copy business process or scale. And scale tends to be, what's really important is relative scale rather than absolute scale. So if you think about those four categories that tend to describe companies that have sustainable competitive advantages, that leads you to certain parts of the market and makes you avoid others. So anything that's highly commoditized, we're not very interested in. Commodity companies, commoditized shipping, anytime you're just competing on price, that tends to not be a very interesting place. Now, on the other hand, if you have something that's very technical, where you have to have your employees train to use some product or service, or you have a long integration process, or you have something that has that's an extremely mission critical product or service, that already kind of piques our interest. But there's no simplistic kind of funnel process or industry focus that we have.
Okay, none of this is, so far is particularly contrarian, but the idea that you gave me is, and it's about, you said it's time for Russian energy companies. Walk me through that.
You know, I was searching for some contrarian ideas.
That certainly qualifies, I would say.
I would say so. Investing in natural resources is not my area, and it's not really my strategy. Having said that, natural resources, commodities, have been quite beaten up for a number of years now, and they're not particularly loved. And if you adjust for some kind of longer term normalized earnings, many energy companies look really inexpensive compared to history. And Russia in particular is also, you know, quite despised as a place to invest, you know, as a place where capital goes to die, if you will. And the reality is some of the largest oil and gas companies in the world are in Russia. Their costs are in rubles, which have depreciated quite substantially over the last few years. And they sell in the global oil markets and the gas markets. And, you know, again, think what you will about Russia, but it's not going anywhere. And our demand for oil and gas is not going anywhere. And a lot of these companies are, you know, incredibly cheap still today. And to the extent that if you believe that sooner or later there's going to be some kind of turn in the cycle and commodity prices will catch a bid, if you will, again, then I think you get sort of a double way to win here, in that both commodities can do better and Russia as an investment destination can do a little bit better. So that's why I picked this idea.
Are there any particular companies within this sector?
Gazprom, Ukoil, Rosneft, a number of those major ones. But I don't think you have to get, you know, particularly fancy here. You know, there's 8 or 9 of the top natural gas and oil companies in Russia. If you look at a basket of those, I think that's a pretty good contrarian portfolio.
Sure. Yeah, it sure is. What else is there as we look into 2020? As far as opportunities or things that maybe investors should be looking out for?
Well, I think investors should be looking at healthcare for the next 12 months, because healthcare is going to be the number one issue, I think, in the upcoming election. It already is, you know, consistently one of the top issues on voters' minds. And the election, whoever you may support politically, is likely to be close. And so there's going to be a lot of volatility about who might win, and the polls will, you know, keep swinging between now and the election. I'm sure it's going to be close to the very end. And big promises will be made by politicians on both sides about healthcare. Of course, the reality is that the ability of the candidate to actually deliver on these policy promises is quite limited without Congress's cooperation. So I think the reality of the impact is going to be fairly small. But there's going to be a lot of volatility in rhetoric that's going to create volatility in some of the company names. And for longer term investors, I think this will spell an opportunity.
Yeah, and we already have seen quite a bit of volatility that's kind of dovetailed with the various candidates' ascendancy. You'll recall a couple of months ago when Elizabeth Warren seemed to be catching a wave that a lot of the HMOs sold off. But that's since turned around.
The U.S. political system is designed for inaction.
Yeah.
If you look at it, you know, two houses of Congress, supermajorities, presidential vetoes, judicial review. This is not a system that's designed for rapid action, except maybe of in times of war where the executive has a lot of power. I think if you look at Obamacare, you know, the Affordable Care Act, there was a ton of rhetoric, but look at the impact it has actually had on the healthcare insurers, on the healthcare drug manufacturers, it's hard to say that they were dramatically hurt in the process. If you look at the financial results of the five largest insurers in the United States, again, it's if I took the years away, I don't think you could point to the year where there's some meaningful impact of the Affordable Care Act, at least from the perspective of their financials.
It may be not the worst idea to buy the dips in some of these healthcare companies, right? Because if what you're saying is that they're going to be around regardless of the political leadership, and if there is a freak out over whoever or presidential tweets or what have you, then that might be an opportunity to establish a position.
Absolutely. And of course, you have to be discerning and you have to know what you're buying. You know, if you're a pharmaceutical company and you're selling a pill which costs you $10 to make and you're selling it for $100,000, I think there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on that. And healthcare prices, especially pharmaceutical prices, are a real lightning rod. And it's something that people really see very clearly. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you're a syringe manufacturer, and there's some companies that make syringes, you know, a 100 pack of these disposable single-use syringes costs $25, so 25 cents a pop. There's really very few people in the hospital system trying to get that price down to 24 cents a pop. Mm. And so if you're selling a high volume of relatively low-priced goods or providing some kind of healthcare service, then I think you're likely to be quite resilient in whatever happens politically.
And there's a company that you like here, which is in your portfolio. And I only know that because I'm staring at your most recent letter here, United Healthcare Group, UNH. You like that when you've been an investor for a while, right?
We actually bought it about 2.5 months ago. And,
okay.
we were very lucky in that we bought it very close to the recent bottom, and that's no testament to my ability to time the markets, but the valuation was extremely compelling. And then, as you pointed out, it just so happened that Elizabeth Warren started fading in the polls. Mm-hmm. They reported good earnings, they upped their buyback, and the stock is up 25% in I think 8 weeks or so. But right. We certainly like United Healthcare for the longer term. Mm-hmm. And that's just the beginning of what I think will be several healthcare investments we'd like to make over the next 12 months.
What other areas of healthcare are you looking at?
Well, we're looking at various services and devices in particular. And again, as I mentioned, these kind of fairly simple, low cost, low price, but high volume things like syringes, catheters, wound care, etc.
Obviously, next year, you touched on it, we have a big election year in the U.S. And with your background, you have some particular views that I'd like to explore, not so much from a political standpoint, but from an investing standpoint, and what potential lessons there could be from next year's presidential election. But let's just first take a short break and then we'll come back.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and anywhere else you find podcasts. Search for Contrarian Investor and supply an honest rating. We want to hear from our listeners. Probably the most efficient way to submit feedback is through the Breaker app, available on the Apple App Store. If you prefer, you can email contrarianpod@gmail.com. You can follow us on social media as well. On Twitter at @podcontrarian and on Instagram at @contrarianpod. Now, back to our regularly scheduled program.
All right, welcome back. We are back now. This stage of the podcast is usually the opportunity for our guest to walk us through his or her origin story, how they got started in investing, and what their career has been like to date.
Certainly. My career is fairly short. I'm still young and I'm still learning. But to give you some background, I generally try to answer the first question I believe people want to know is about where's the accent from? And I was born in Warsaw, Poland. I grew up in the UK, Hungary, then Poland again. And I moved to the United States during high school. And I went to high school in Columbia, Missouri, in the Midwest.
Okay.
And while I was in high school, I got the opportunity to co-found a software company. I'm a self-taught software programmer. I had a small software business already in Poland at the age of 14. Wow. But I started this software for political consulting, political legislative tracking while I was in Missouri. And again, it was quite serendipitous. I had a friend who I was working with at a small business, and he came to me, he said, well, I have these lobbyist friends. They're asking me if I can build them something for tracking legislation better than they're doing it now because it's so cumbersome. He came to me because he knew I could write software. And he said, you know, can you look at this? And I said, I looked at it. Well, yeah, I think we could do something about this. And then lo and behold, you know, we launched a business around it. So that's what we did. I did that for about a year. But then I, you know, I had a perfect ACT score. So that led to several full ride, full scholarship offers. And I had deferred already for a year between high school and college. But I thought to myself, I should probably go and get a degree because these offers may not last. And I really wanted to go to New York and see sort of the New York area. And the closest school to New York that offered me a full ride was Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up going there. And I was very fortunate in that they offered me a full scholarship, but also in that they let me graduate in just 2 years from what is normally a four-year degree program. They let me off for good behavior, as I like to say. And I went back to St. Louis after that, where my company was based. And a year later, we sold the company to a bigger outfit in DC. And the other part, I think, is was quite lucky is that I was, you know, I went to college between 2007 and 2009. So I was really in the New York area during the financial crisis, and I saw it unfolding. And I thought that was very informative to me. And especially in the sense that there was a lot of people who had a lot of trust in the system and preconceived ideas about the system, whereas I sort of knew nothing. But it also gave me this kind of fresh set of eyes to see what was really happening, at least, you know, sort of on the surface. And every day there were a lot of things that people believed that were turning out to be not true. You know, there were banks that were telling you, we have lots of capital, we don't need any capital, things are going great. And then a week later, they had a $20 billion write-down, or they accepted a bailout, or things of that nature. Sold the company in 2010, became financially independent at the age of 23. I've long invested personally and wanted to invest for a long time, but I never, you know, quite got into it because I just kind of kept falling into the software stuff, which, by the way, I never have any formal training in software. I always studied finance. And I said, well, what do I do next with my life? And I said, well, maybe I should get an MBA because that's the thing you're supposed to do at some point. And I got to go and get an MBA from Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. And as part of that program, I traveled to Hong Kong for a semester abroad. I studied in Hong Kong. I met my future wife in Hong Kong during this trip. Yeah. And the good thing is the program, they don't charge you any extra in the MBA if you meet your spouse through it. So that worked out well.
There's no referral bonus or anything that they get.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I graduated spring of 2012, moved to Hong Kong summer of 2012. And my wife is a professor. And she had a position in Hong Kong.
We almost overlapped in Hong Kong, by the way. I was there from 2015 to 2017.
Yeah, we definitely overlapped because I was in Hong Kong till the summer of 2017.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, yeah, we definitely overlapped. But I didn't meet you there. That's weird because it's such a small community, especially in the financial world. But getting back on – yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
No, no. So I moved to Hong Kong summer of 2012, and I launched my fund October 2012. And I ran it there for close to 5 years. So while my wife was working there, and then her contract in Hong Kong eventually finished, we had a young kid. And I said, well, let's go back to the U.S. and let's go somewhere with no state income tax. Which is how we ended up in Austin, Texas.
You know, the curious thing here, what I notice as you're going through all this is that, you know, you had this experience, your first experience in finance and working in investing was in 2008 and 2009. And most people, if that was their first experience, you figure they would kind of run for the hills. But you decided to deepen your involvement at that point.
You know, I would say I am not very emotionally affected by what happens in the markets. And I'm not very, I have a fairly narrow emotional amplitude. So I don't get, you know, I don't feel much despair when things are going badly. And this year, you know, we're having a fantastic year at my fund, and I'm also not like ecstatic about it either. So I never saw the 2008 crisis as this generational, you know, crisis that destroyed my faith in the capitalist system. Mm. And I remember a lot of people framing in that sense, like this huge belief in housing and all these other things and Wall Street banks. And it somehow they thought this was like the end of capitalism as we know it. And I never saw it that way. I was like, well, the system's gonna reset and companies will keep on making money and things will kind of continue as they were, more or less. And I think that's largely been the way, you know, outside of the finance industry specifically, I think largely, you know, high quality companies have continued to do really well over the last 10 years. Mm. And American capitalism has done really well overall.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about America. This election next year, you have some views on this.
The historical record is that incumbent presidents tend to get reelected. And more to the point, if there is no recession in the election year, incumbent presidents, generally speaking, are reelected with 100% probability. If you look at the last 150 years of presidents, we've had 19 presidents, two of them die in office, 17 then run for reelection. And of those 17, 12 have no recession in the election year, and 12 out of 12 get reelected. And on the flip side, every single one that runs for reelection during a recession loses. Hmm. And so I don't care who you support politically, but I think you should be mindful of the base rates. And the base rates suggest that an incumbent president running in a good economy tends to get reelected. And so you should expect that Trump will be reelected. Mm-hmm. If Trump is not reelected, that would be a big surprise relative to history.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what does one do as an investor? Let's assume that Trump is reelected in next year. What does that mean for markets, for stocks?
That tends to, in my view, that tends to mean that there's less policy uncertainty and there's less policy change. And I think there's going to be a lot of expectation or risk or volatility around policy expectations for the next 12 months running up to the election. And I think at the end of the day, policy stability is most likely to prevail. So taxes are likely to stay fairly low. Interest rates are fairly, you know, contained. And I think there's probably no major financial regulation or healthcare regulation that comes down the line.
So there's been some talk recently about the U.S. and maybe Europe being poised for a little bit more growth than it has seen over the last, I guess since the crisis. Do you have any views on that?
Yeah, I actually think growth in the U.S. is fairly robust as it is. And I think if anything is likely to come down, and it's simply a function of demographics. It's a function of productivity growth. And it's a function of the fact that we already have extremely low unemployment. So it's not obvious who else you can get to join the labor force that has the right skills, the right education to really meaningfully contribute. And I think what you're seeing all around the world, and especially in advanced economies, is fairly low and declining growth rates. And that's to be expected, as again, as population growth is much slower around the world. And I think the most important part that's overlooked has to do with the growth in productivity, which has also been fairly anemic around the world. If you think about the economy overall, today, manufacturing in the United States is about 10% of GDP. And therefore, any productivity gains in manufacturing don't translate into a lot of gains for the economy as a whole. And where the U.S. economy is really growing and creating jobs are things like healthcare, education, and personal services, both for the young and the old, taking care of the young, taking care of the old. And in those areas, it's very, very difficult to create a lot of productivity gains. And again, without productivity gains, it's hard to see how you kind of have rising living standards, rising wages. And I would go even further than that. In those areas, healthcare, education, personal care, we don't necessarily as consumers want productivity. I mean, productivity is because the antithesis of what we want as consumers. Education, productivity means more children per teacher. In healthcare, it means fewer minutes per session with your doctor. In personal services, again, it means more computers and automation and less of a human touch. And so those are not things that most of us are seeking, right? We want more teacher attention for our child. We want more time with our doctor. And I think as a result, we should expect that productivity gains as a whole on the level of the economy are likely to be slower going forward. And I think that's true all over the world. And to the extent that the United States demographics are a little younger and we're growing a little faster than the rest of the world, if you believe that the U.S. demographics will trend more towards where Europe and Japan are today, then you think, I believe that the growth trajectory is likely to follow as well. So I think the U.S. GDP growth is likely to slow down into the next decade or so and grow slower than it has over the last decade.
Right. Well, there's a couple things there. The productivity, I mean, consumers might be okay with productivity if it comes with lower costs and increased convenience. And okay, the teacher thing is that's a fair point. And the doctors probably too. But at the same time, if there were a way to lower the cost of healthcare through technology somehow, and if that could lead to fewer doctor visits, I mean, I don't know if anybody really looks forward to going to the doctor or the dentist. Right. And if there was some way of kind of, yeah, through technology, like removing that or making it a little easier and not to mention cheaper, wouldn't that be a win-win for the consumers? And
oh, yeah. I mean, look, it would be. It's just there's no obvious, way of achieving that. So, I mean, the idea box is wide open.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, there's a lot of people are trying to live healthier and do things that would make you go less to the doctor. And there's certainly, on the learning education side, there's all sorts of e-learning platforms and online education. Right. And those things are working out for some people. But I'm just saying overall, the progress is not, is not large in terms of percentages in a way that would really move the needle for us.
And that's interesting coming from you who got his start in software. Mm-hmm. That you don't seem to have very much faith in there being a technological solution to this to help drive productivity gains. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I mean, I just would say that GDP growth is not this god that we should worship. Right. And if you look at it, sort of issues of equality, justice, social mobility, women's rights, minority rights, those are all sorts of things that I think are worthy goals of pursuing that I think we're going to make progress and we continue to make progress as society that don't necessarily directly translate into GDP. And that's perfectly fine. Protecting the environment, guaranteeing a safe and clean environment for our kids, again, doesn't necessarily directly contribute to GDP, but is a perfectly worthwhile goal to pursue. I'm always amazed at how Japan is portrayed by sort of the economics profession. I keep reading these editorials from very smart people. Larry Summers, for example, they kind of write these things like, the West must really work hard to avoid this disaster of Japan, or like we must avoid Japanification. And like, I've been to Japan many times, it has the highest life expectancy in the world. The environment is clean. There's clean food. There's extremely low levels of violence, which are murder, rape, you know, serious crimes. The infrastructure is fantastic. So it's like Japan is presented as this basket case. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I think most people, if you tell them you can live a long life with low threats of violence in a clean environment where families are relatively close to each other, that doesn't sound like this terrible disaster to most people.
Is there any way that you can marry that one can, as an investor? ESG is a huge topic, which some might say is more marketing than anything else. And leave that alone for now. But is there any way as an investor that one can get that one can legitimately invest in things that do make the world a better place? And is that something that you look to do at all? Or is it just kind of you divide where like, okay, look, this is, I'm an investor and it's all about profits. That's what my investors want from me. And that's what I'm going to do. And all else out the window. Or how do you balance that?
So I don't have an ESG mandate. And I don't necessarily think through the traditional ESG lens. But what I would say is I am very focused on the long-term competitive advantage of companies. And with that, you want to think about a company and the value it creates for people. And you want to be in a business which creates value for a lot of people, and one that would be missed if it were to go away. You don't want to be an owner of a business which is just screwing people left, right, and center, and everyone's just wishing and hoping for its demise. Because something will go wrong. And over time, I think history has taught us that if you are acting in that kind of way, over time, society tends to take away your license to do business through various means. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's how I would think about it. The company certainly can make money doing it and charge relatively high prices. But you want a business that creates value for people and that people would actually miss. So that's kind of how I think for the ESG lens.
That's pretty cool. All right. And so it's fair to say that underlies all your investing.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the businesses that we're investing in, we want them to create a lot of value and hopefully capture quite a bit for shareholders.
Okay. Is there anything that you are concerned about if you look at your portfolio, if you look at markets as we go into 2020?
I'm not that concerned about the markets per se or my portfolio. You know, I sleep very well at night. Mm. I do think overall income inequality is probably an understated risk. It's a risk that is often framed in terms of justice and equality, but I think it is a risk to markets over the longer term. If you get more and more, you know, ongoing wealth concentration at the top, you know, wealthy hedge fund managers getting more and more of their income, you know, there's only so many steaks we can eat, if you will. And if the bottom 60, 70, 80% of society doesn't have enough income, then you have to ask yourself, you know, how are they going to consume? And therefore, if they're not going to consume, does that put us in some kind of permanent slump economically? Mm. And traditionally, the answer in the US for the last 30 years has been saying, well, if you don't have a lot of income, we just push a lot of credit to these kinds of groups of people, right? And this has created bubble after bubble. And now we're in this environment where, you know, you have to have an incredibly good credit score to get any kind of financing. And you really have this ongoing, you know, wealth divide. Mm. So I don't have a crystal ball where this leads, but I think you do need people to have income to consume and you know, sustain this economy. Mm. So I think this kind of short-sightedness of funneling more and more money to the top of the pyramid, which you know, I want to be quite clear, I'm a perfect beneficiary of. I think it has negative long-term consequences that are troubling.
Yeah, you're the second person, the second guest in a row now that has touched on this. Last week we had a Nicholas Jackson, who's a British author, who wrote a book called The Finance Curse. Mm-hmm. And it talks about how global finance, the whole industry, is kind of an extractor of wealth from maybe not for the few people at the very top of the pyramid, but for the society at large. And he went into that at great depth. So a bit of a shameless plug there for our podcast from last week. But my point is that this is certainly something if you're, and it's not just us, you know, I saw Ray Dalio speak a couple weeks ago, and it was the main thing that he talked about. And, you know, it's talking about marketing. I mean, maybe that was his, what he wanted to accomplish with that. But so what? I mean, the point is he's still talking about it. Mm-hmm. And it's not him. It's not just them. It's everybody. And so this is certainly something that, you know, not the type of thing that you plan to talk about on an investing podcast, but it's something that, that does come up. And this political stuff also comes up all the time in when you talk to investors, you know, not on podcasts, just in general discussions.
This concludes our podcast episode for today. We thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe to the podcast, follow us on social media, and get in touch with any questions or concerns at PodContrarian on Twitter, ContrarianPod on Instagram, or email contrarianpod@gmail.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next week.
It's time to get down to business with $30 a month business internet. WOW Business offers 99.9% network reliability so that you can keep your business moving. $30 a month gets you 30 megabytes per second with 24/7 US-based support, a price lock guarantee, and a 60-day satisfaction guarantee. Lock in our lowest priced offer for the support you need. Go to switchtowellbusiness.com. Offer for new customers with a 2-year agreement subject to change. Prices do not include taxes, fees, and equipment charges. Restrictions apply.